Okay, we have gone through the first quest, which technically was just called the quest of the historical Jesus. Then we looked at the no quest period, which we gave, what, four reasons why there was no quest, or four things that were occurring during the time period in which there was no quest. Yes, it was four. Then we talked about the new quest, which will eventually be called the second quest. The new quest began by a guy named Ernst Caseman. And when did he begin? October 20th, 1953. And what made it ironic, the beginnings of the second quest? Yeah.
It starts the lecture and Rudolph Bolton was there.
Yeah, and why is that an interesting addition? Yeah. Yeah, it was his teacher. And what was Boltmann's disposition towards the quest of the historical Jesus? Should not do it. Don't engage it. It's all myth. It doesn't. The history can never be gotten to. So in Boltmann's presence, the second quest launches. And I ended last class giving a couple of names of people that were, over the next 20 years or so, very big in the second quest. Names like C.H. Dodd, Günter Bornkamm, Norman Perrin and Edward Schillebeeks. Now, the key difference, though, between the first quest and the second quest was what? What was the first quest's motivation? Or at its center, what was it doing? Yes, separating the Jesus of faith from the Jesus of history, right? Now, what's the second quest intending to do? Bring them back together. So that they don't fall into docetism, and so that they also don't fall into the other reality of Jesus only being human and no longer divine. One of the key developments during the second quest was what is called double dissimilarity criterion. Double dissimilarity criterion. So double dissimilarity criterion, which is the singular form of criteria. Criterion. I-O-N is how you spell that, in case you didn't know. The double dissimilarity criterion says this. Actually, I'm going to define it through Norman Perrin because he says it wonderfully. He says this method is as follows. The earliest form of a saying. So they're looking for the historical Jesus, the earliest form. The earliest form of a saying we can reach may be regarded as authentic if it can be shown to be dissimilar, so here's the criterion, to characteristic emphases both of ancient Judaism, so if it is dissimilar to ancient Judaism, and of the early church. So in the second quest, one of their ways of getting back to the very earliest strata of a saying, we know it is truly historical if we can prove it is dissimilar to Judaism and dissimilar to Christianity. If we can prove there is no influence from Judaism inside of a saying, or any influence of the early church in a saying, then we know we have something that is authentic. We know that we have something from the historical Jesus. So the criterion of double dissimilarity is something that the second quest develops, and something that, frankly, in the third quest will be debated. Yes? Yeah, yes, that it's the latter. They would be saying there would be no way of clearly saying whether or not the saying was authentic of the historical Jesus if we see influence of Judaism. So it's not saying that it doesn't, that it wasn't the historical Jesus that said it, but they would say there'd be no way to actually validate that Jesus said it.
Because it had influence from early
Judaism? Because it had influence from somewhere else. And that will be something the third quest will push back on because of that reason. But yes, but again, the whole point is not to discount that something okay, that could never have been said by the historical Jesus. That's not what they're saying. What they're saying is to get back to the earliest strata, something that we know is authentic without question. If it is dissimilar from Judaism, dissimilar from Christianity, then we could say, well, we know this wasn't coming from an influence of an agenda from the Jews or from the Christians. Because it doesn't match any other stuff. Since it doesn't match either one, it must be authentic. Now, it doesn't mean that the other things that are influenced by them isn't authentic. It just means they can't validate that, especially with this criterion. Okay? Now, I'm going to share the sentiment that you expressed there in a minute. But I understand what they're saying. That makes sense on some level. Now, granted, you're left with very little. But nevertheless, what you're left with, even if you're left with little, it doesn't mean you have nothing, and that's an advantage. That's a bonus. I have something to build on. And that's at least better than what it is that you would have if you had nothing to build on. Okay? The end of the quest, it's highly debated. Some people don't even believe the second quest has really totally ended. Some people believe that it ended in the early to mid 1980s. As a matter of fact, in 1982, a man by the name of N.T. Wright, he writes a journal article entitled "Towards a Third Quest?" Jesus Then and Now. So he, anytime that you hear third quest, it was actually originally coined or originally said by N.T. Wright. And the whole point of this article was actually not to argue for a new quest in the sense of chronologically. It's not like we have the first quest, that stopped and ended, second quest stopped and ended, the third quest. He actually, in the article, is asking that we start a parallel quest to the second one. He was saying, you know, another option. He is calling us specifically to a methodological difference. To, if we're having the second quest being dominated by double dissimilarity, the question then becomes, well, what about another way of approaching this? And so really what N.T. Wright is asking for or calling to is a methodological shift. A third quest that comes along that the methodology is so categorically different that it could not be called a part of the second quest because it is so different, even if their aims are similar, even if their goals are similar. So he writes an article towards a third quest? And the whole point would be to pursue the historical Jesus by countering the hyper-skepticism of the second quest. Which the second quest, I mean, as we just saw with the criterion of double dissimilarity, hyper-skepticism. If there's any influence of Judaism, any influence of early church, throw it out. And so N.T. Wright's calling for something different. Now, people don't necessarily point towards that date alone as the start of the third quest, but you see rumblings of it in 1982. A lot of people point towards a major shift that occurs in 1985. 1985, two things happen in 1985 that will send shockwaves. Well, one of which sends it for about the next 15 years, one of which is still continuing, not just in historical Jesus, but even into Paul. The one that sends shockwaves for about 15 years or so was the launch of what was called the Jesus Seminar. The Jesus Seminar, which embraces double dissimilarity to an infinite degree. Begins in 1985, founded by a guy named Robert Funk. I promise that's his name. Funk. The Jesus Seminar was basically this. It was a group of scholars that got in a room, and they were known for their colored beads. What they would do is they would go saying by saying of the sayings of Jesus, and based on different criterion, primarily, though, double dissimilarity, all the scholars in the room, after hearing the saying and debating over it and giving input, they then would cast a color bead. If it was a red bead, then it was something definitely Jesus said. If it was a black bead, it was something that he did not say. And then they also had, I believe, two colors in the middle, gray and pink. So maybe he said it, the pink one, gray. More than likely he didn't say it, but he could have. Black, he definitely didn't say it. Red, he definitely said it. Okay? So they would color it, and they actually put out their version of the gospel is called, I believe, the fifth gospel. And it's color-coded. The whole gospel is color-coded based off of what the collective group voted on as the color of the beads. And it's very small. Like, we're talking authentic ones, red sayings, actual red, not much at all.
Does it rule out a lot of his claims about himself?
That depends on what you would mean. I mean, it does. There's a lot of the question of whether or not Jesus would have been self-aware is something that was also raging in the early 20th century. And any self-proclamations that are too blatant, they probably would have questioned. Yeah, but I mean, honestly, their criterion on every saying is pretty convoluted. And from what I remember, the fifth gospel not only has it color-coded, but it usually will have some sort of an explanation of why it is that the color got what it was. Yeah?
You're kind of answering this a little bit, but what did a lot of those red sands look like? Is there kind of a pattern?
You know what? There was. I'd have to review them all in order to give a comprehensive answer to that. But my initial response would be definitely whenever there was talks of kingdom. So the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. That one would have been more widely accepted. Well, because we also find some of the ones also that are found in the Gospel of Thomas were more easily embraced. Because the Gospel of Thomas, this is the Jesus Seminar is one of the primary catalysts of taking the Gospel of Thomas and making it even earlier than the canonical Gospels. Like they really revered. They highly revered the Gospel of Thomas, eventually even in some sense the Gospel of Peter, although nothing touches the Gospel of Thomas. And we've read some of those sayings. So if you found parallels in there, which like the mustard seed, the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, that's in the Gospel of Thomas, at least a form of that. So a lot of kingdom talk was something that they were okay with. The second thing that happens in 1985 is the publication of, frankly, one of the most influential works, I think, in the past couple hundred years, maybe even the last 300 to 400 years. It's a work by the name of Jesus and Judaism by a guy named E.P. Sanders. E.P. Sanders, Jesus and Judaism. It's interesting, whenever this was a four-hour class, we used to use that extra hour. We would use it for oral presentations, so you don't have to do that anymore. But we would also use it to Skype in with scholars around the world. So I would have Helen Bond, who wrote a book on historical Jesus, Skype usually after this session. And one of the things that students would always ask, and it was a question-answer time. Students could ask them whatever questions. And one of the questions that would a lot of times be asked is, hey, what books would you suggest us to read? And what was interesting is it didn't matter if we were talking to Helen Bond or Michael Gorman or Chris Keith or Anthony LaDon. Every one of them said, oh, you have to read E.P. Sanders' Jesus and Judaism. Or at least, Palestinian Judaism. I think it's that one. Yeah. But anyway, they would always say that, Jesus and Judaism. Why? It is groundbreaking. Primarily what E.P. Sanders does is gives us a different framework with which to engage the Pharisees, the Jewish religion as a whole. He really attacks, and in a sense, if you guys have heard of the New Perspective, if you've taken Romans, you'll have heard about the New Perspective, at least I hope you have. But the New Perspective was birthed from the ramifications of E.P. Sanders' work. And the question is Paul really writing against a works-based religion? And E.P. Sanders would say, absolutely not. That is not what the Pharisees were. They were not thinking that they were keeping the laws so as to earn their salvation. No, it was way deeper than that. That's not what the Jewish religion was. And as he begins to recast the Jewish religion, it changes then even a lot of what Jesus was engaging. It changes then even the ways in which we understand Galatians and Romans and the impact of this book really, in a sense, is not attacking, it is challenging significantly, and I think very influentially. I think E.P. Sanders is right on the majority of the stuff he's talking about with this. But it challenges stuff that was assumed since Martin Luther. I mean, whenever I say the last 300-400 years, this book is one of the most influential, it's because of what it challenges that was assumed in not works, but faith alone. Well, that's an understanding of the way the Catholics were teaching at the time, cast back onto the Pharisees, and then brought back around into a new Protestant theology. But E.P. Sanders comes along and says, actually, that's not the way the Pharisees were looking at this. That's not what Jesus was speaking to, and that's not what Paul was speaking against. They were talking about other things. So, things like the emphasis of communal salvation and not just individual. E.P. Sanders brings that out in a way in which a lot of our individualistic society isn't even totally prepared to embrace. It's a groundbreaking work, and that happens in 1985 that sends shockwaves throughout gospel studies. Okay? So some people look at this middle portion of this time of when the third quest really begins to emerge. Major players of the third quest, people like E.P. Sanders, Marcus Borg, B-O-R-G, Marcus Borg, James Dunn, D-U-N-N, I'll say these names again, D-U-N-N, Jimmy Dunn, James Dunn. You have E.P. Sanders, Marcus Borg, James Dunn, John Dominic Crossan. John Dominic Crossan. You also have Robert Funk, so if you really just, for the oral exam, if you want to remember that name, you can. Funk. E.P. Sanders, Marcus Borg, John Dominic Crossan, Robert Funk, James Dunn. I mean, there's others, you know, Giza Vermes, Ben Meyer, but that at least gives you a representative. Okay? You okay if I move to key developments in the third quest? Key developments, third quest. What makes the third quest radically different? The first one, I think will actually stick out to you pretty distinctly. The third quest is known for, at the very beginning of their works, disclosing all of their presuppositions. Starting it off saying, I'm admitting that I'm coming at it, this topic from this perspective, with this presupposition, with this assumption. Why is that so interesting? Why is that a fascinating shift in this whole trend? Yeah. Okay, that's a vivid metaphor, yes. Yes, it's a distinct pushback on modernism, yeah? They're acknowledging from the beginning, I'm not objective. Matter of fact, it's fascinating. I just saw on my Twitter feed, Edinburgh is doing an entire series of lectures asking this question. Is it okay, or should we challenge the methodology of being agnostic or atheistic to do religious studies? Because in some sense, that's what you're being asked. That's what you're asked to be. To do effective studies of religion, to be objective, is to be either agnostic or atheistic, in the sense of, I'm not coming at this with a faith, I'm coming at this with pure reason. You see, that methodology goes back hundreds of years into modernity. It's very interesting or striking that the third quest people are starting off going, yeah, these are my presuppositions. Blah, 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 blah. Frankly, there's a part of it where I'm going, good, you've read Schweitzer. Schweitzer tells us that my goodness, one of the things we're struggling with after the first quest is the fact that a lot of times the Jesus that people conclude looks a lot like them. Looks a lot like them. Even in the third quest, you have this. It's not like you don't. Matter of fact, Craig Evans, when he was here a couple of years ago at a dinner with some of us profs, he was telling us about a story with John Dominic Crossan, and he calls him Dom. He was like, he goes, yeah, we were at this conference a while back. He said it was a couple years ago, and you know, and everybody was around Dom, and they were talking to him, all these students asking him questions, because he is so influential in the third quest. That, I mean, he's like your version of a scholarly rock star. I mean, so all the students are around him, they're like, Dom, you know, asking him all these questions. And one of them even asked, they said, was Jesus, though, if he was a peasant up in Galilee, would he have really experienced the oppression of the Roman Empire significantly in his life? Or would he have been able to exist? And yeah, maybe had some, but not really impacted by it. And John Dominic Crossan starts describing it. He was like, do you know what it's like to be walking down the street and no one look at you? Do you know what it's like to have people that will, that won't even, that sociologically basically murder you by not even acknowledging your existence. Do you know what it's like? And he starts going, and by the end of it, he is shaking. And Craig Evans says, he goes, I finally said, Dom, are you talking about Jesus? Or are you talking about your childhood? And he said, there was this moment where John Dominic Crossan's kind of stopped, and he looked up at him, and he was just silent. Why? Because there is a part of all of us that we see ourselves in Jesus. And there's a part of me that says, and that's not a bad thing. That's one of the gracious gifts I think that God has given us by becoming incarnate. Is that every one of us can look at Jesus and see a part of ourselves in him, which should be the case if we're created in the image of God. That whenever God becomes flesh, we see ourselves in him. Well, both we see ourselves positively and we see ourselves negatively. You should see yourself reflected, which is, again, one of the most startling things. That's actually part of the key points I was trying to make this past Tuesday in the sermon, is that whenever Jesus is revealed most clearly, what is overwhelming is how clearly then you are revealed simultaneously. Not because you are him, but because you are created in the image of God, of which he is the image of that which we cannot see. That's Colossians 1. That's why I threw out the Hebrews 1. He is the exact representation of God's being. If I wanted to keep going, it's because of John 14. Because Jesus and the Father are one. If you have seen the Son, you have seen the Father. Because I and the Father are one, he says. It's because John 1:18, Jesus exegetes God. And if we are created in the image of God, then the more clearly Jesus becomes, the more clearly we should see our true selves, who we are meant to be, not were, as if we are no longer. We are meant to be. Jesus reveals true God and true humanity simultaneously. So there's a part of it where I'm going, this isn't something we need to be upset about or apologize for. This is something that, for me, is another evidence of God's incredible grace. Movement towards me. Movement towards us. Third quest discloses their presuppositions. The third quest also emphasizes articulating their methodology. This is what I am going, this is how I am going to define the historical Jesus. How I'm going to, in a sense, divine the historical Jesus, to pull it out. Methodology matters huge in Third Quest. I would say methodology matters more every time that you go up to a new level of degree study. Methodology matters. So let's give some of the big methodology tactics used by the Third Questers. Number one, you have a, really this is more of a debate, but it's a debate over methodology. You have some that they buy into atomistic or atomism methodology, and others that buy into more holism or holistic methodologies. And these two methodologies look something like this. Those that take atomistic exegesis or atomism, they will look at all of the small, small details, and from the small details, then they will make a big picture. This is your Jesus seminar. We're going to figure out what sayings we can even rely on at all. And they get down to just a handful. And they say, from this, we will then create the picture of the historical Jesus. Atomistic. Looking at the very smallest atoms. You see that? Then you have the other methodology, which is the opposite. They begin big. What if we looked at Jesus with this lens, this big lens, and from that, we dive deep into the details and we test this lens to see where it is strong and see where it is weak. So they begin large picture, big picture, and they zoom in. They begin, atomistic begins zoomed in, and then they zoom out. Okay? Strengths and weaknesses on both. The majority of your third questers will be taking the holistic. That's your John Dominic Crossan, even N.T. Wright, James Dunn. They're starting with a big picture, and then they zoom into the details. Your Jesus seminar is an example of an atomistic exegesis. That's how they did it. There's also actually another latent debate in this. It's just under the surface. Do you begin with Jesus' sayings or do you begin with his deeds? which one do you use as the entry point to then develop your greater picture? Just food for thought. Number two debate is over double dissimilarity. The methodology of double dissimilarity, you see polar opposites in the third quest. You obviously, the double dissimilarity you see in the Jesus seminar, they buy into it to the nth degree. I mean, if there is even a scent of Judaism or of Christianity, they get rid of it. Or they make it a gray bead or a pink one. Even a scent of it. Then you have the majority of the other ones reject this criterion because of how it obscures. Because there is a weirdness of this where it's going, listen, if Jesus is Jewish, and even Ramirez in the first quest buys that, he's the one that kicked that off. If he is Jewish, but you kick out all the things that are influenced by Judaism, then how can you say you have a clear picture of the historical Jesus? And then they would also say the same about Christianity. Now, if Christianity is something that is so toxic to the picture of Jesus, then why is it that Christians adopted Jesus to begin with? Because on some level, they would say, he has to look Christian on some level, otherwise Christians wouldn't revere him. So to kick out everything that is Christian, they would argue, is again obscuring and not clarifying the historical Jesus. So you have the criterion of double dissimilarity not just coming under attack, but most third questers just put it to death. They're like, no, that's not helpful at all. So what are some of the other methodologies they adopt? Multiple independent attestation. Multiple independent attestation. We've actually done this in here, even though you didn't know that's what it was called. Multiple independent attestation. This methodology asserts that historical authenticity of Jesus, or for the details of Jesus, can be found in any element that is found in multiple unrelated early sources. Finding multiple unrelated early sources, so multiple independent attestation to a fact, presents that particular fact is highly probable of being something that truly is historical for the historical Jesus. Where have we done that in this class? Yeah, notice we went through all of these different Roman sources, Josephus, Suetonius, and the things we kept pointing out were, isn't it interesting that he is almost unanimously, even by the enemies, referred to as a wise man, a miracle worker. Multiple times we have him being crucified under Pontius Pilate. A mischievous superstition that's coming up, right? We were engaging this. Whenever you can look at it from multiple sources and they're all saying this, and they're not even canonical, they're not even the gospel saying it, then that gives you a pretty strong indication that that is something that is true of the historical Jesus. Personally, I think that makes a lot of sense. I like that methodology. Matter of fact, John Dominic Crossan even suggests that the complete avoidance of any unit of the Jesus tradition found only in single attestation, even within the first stratum, so even within the very early text, is the methodology by which we can discover the historical Jesus. If you only find the detail in one document, it shouldn't be trusted. But when you find it in multiple, that's whenever you know you're on the right track. You also have what's called the embarrassment element. The embarrassment element. Apologetics has hijacked this in more recent times, especially in our context. But third questers look at elements that would have been embarrassing for the early church would not have been fabricated because the early church was under so much pressure. If anything, the early church would have tried to make themselves look better. So women discovering the tomb, that's an embarrassment element in the context that the early church would not have fabricated. It just wouldn't have happened. Especially whenever they're under in persecution. The crucifixion itself, not something the early church would have fabricated. If they were create literally, and this is something I definitely buy into, if the early church was creating a God king out of nothing, they did it the absolute worst possible way in the context they were in. It was a terrible way to start a movement. Unless that's the way it happened. So that's the embarrassment element, which you can pull from that as the fruit. Why would they fabricate this, especially in a highly toxic situation or a context? Another methodology, interdisciplinary studies. This is a hallmark of third questers. Interdisciplinary study. Third questers use multiple perspectives to develop their picture of the historical Jesus, from philosophy to archaeology to sociology to anthropology to empire studies. They're pulling from everything in order to develop that. So you're Wayne Meeks, and eventually on some level you're Richard Horsley's and even Warren Carter's, which you guys, you didn't read it. No, that's another class. Use of, and this is number 6 or 7 or something, use of non-canonical sources is a major methodological choice of third questers. They utilize sources that are non-canonical. In some sense, they prioritize things like the Gospel of Thomas, the secret Gospel of Mark, Gospel of Peter, even over and above canonical Gospels, which I find to be methodologically flawed. But third questers, non-canonical sources, a big deal. They use them a lot. Okay? We good? Makes sense what their methodology is. All right, we have 2 to 3 minutes. I'm going to start ripping off 10 conclusions of the third quest that border on consensus, which in scholarly world is crazy to get a consensus on anything. But these are 10 facts or 10 conclusions about the historical Jesus that third questers border on consensus. Number one, Jesus was Jewish. There is a consensus, that in a general agreement, that Jesus was Jewish. The Jewishness of Jesus is routinely taken seriously by third questers. Number two, Jesus was, this word's important, considered. They're not admitting that they agree, but Jesus was considered an exorcist and a miracle worker. Jesus was considered at the time an exorcist and a miracle worker. The first quest would never have admitted that. It was driven by deists. They would have been naturalizing everything to the point where it's gone. The reality that this is a fact really points towards Strauss's influence. No, we're going to look at the document, multiple independent attestation. He is considered an exorcist and a miracle worker. Number three, Jesus was baptized by John the Baptizer. Jesus was baptized by John the Baptizer. Consensus around that point as well. Jesus had a baptism, and it was by a guy named John, who was known, even in Josephus, as John the Baptizer. Number four, Jesus taught and preached in Galilee. Now, exactly what he taught and preached, that's highly debated. But the fact that he taught and preached in Galilee, that is a borderline consensus point. So let me reread these while you guys are writing that one down. Jesus was Jewish. He was considered an exorcist and a miracle worker, baptized by John the Baptizer, taught and preached in Galilee. Number five, Jesus drew followers to himself. Consensus. He did have followers. He drew followers to himself. Again, these are conclusions from the third quest that border on consensus. Number six, Jesus made a final journey to Jerusalem for Passover. Jesus made a final journey to Jerusalem for Passover. All of the Gospels have this final movement, this final journey to Jerusalem for Passover that kicks off the last week and ends in his resurrection. Although you will notice that they will stop before that point. Number seven, Jesus had an incident in the temple in the final week of his life. And they love using that word incident because they do not want to get into the details of exactly what happened. They're like, no, there, something happened. An incident occurs in the temple in the final week of Jesus' life. Jesus had an incident in the temple in the final week of his life. Number 8, Jesus was arrested. We know that happens. And they always, well, not always. They generally connect it to that incident, that the incident leads to his arrest. But they all agree on some sense, general consensus, that Jesus was arrested. And number 9, Jesus was convicted by Pontius Pilate. Wasn't just that he was arrested, but Jesus is convicted by Pontius Pilate. And we saw that in our own exercise of multiple independent attestation, that that is something that is widely, widely accepted. And number 10, Jesus was crucified. Third questers agree, consensus, he was crucified. What do they not agree on? His resurrection. Which we can talk about that more on Tuesday. Love you guys. See you then.